This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I have to say, your hair is looking especially lustrous today, and that only means one thing to me. Obviously, the battle for paradise has begun.
It really has, Chris, and I have to say that I really think Worf for passing over his Klingon mane and tail shampoo, because it really has given me a look that I have been going for my whole life. And
I'm sure Matthew,
I wish listeners can see this right now.
I know. This is why we should do video on the shows.
We'd have to shower then.
Yeah, but then, Matthew, they would see that giant gorge on your nose.
Chris, you said you were not going to mention that on the show.
I'm sorry.
You said it was hardly noticeable, Chris. Come on.
So obviously today, everyone, we are going to be continuing our series about Worf's journey to DS9 and how his time with the TNG crew mixed together with his time with the DS9 crew, as we are on Star Trek Insurrection, which takes place, as we'll discuss in a moment, sometime during or right around the end of the Deep Space Nine series. Matthew, speaking of the hair, I know you've seen the, I don't know if you'd call it a meme, but there's that image that's been going around for years of Worf with the very long hair from Insurrection, and it's like a L'Oreal or something like that ad.
I mean, you got to have your Pantene Pro-V Worf commercials in Starfleet. Quark was really glad when he came to the station because he could start playing those commercials then. They had those commercials that Quark ran.
Right.
And the mugs that came out said Quark's on them. Well, you know, you'd print your, you know, I mean, you'd get your bottle of shampoo at the replicator. It would come out and it had, you know, Pantene Worf on it. So
I think of those commercials. Do you remember when Fabio used to do commercials for I Can't Believe It's Not Butter?
Yes, I remember those very well.
And then
they
had the one where he's like on a gondola in the canals in Venice or somewhere, and it's supposed to be very romantic, and he's got the really long hair like Worf does here in Insurrection when they're out on the hillside, except it was a commercial for I Can't Believe It's Not Butter spray. And Fabio delivers the line, I can't believe it's not butter, spray. It's the cheesiest thing ever.
Oh gosh, I can picture Worf doing that too. You know, in his really dry sense of humor. I can't believe it's not butter spray.
Okay, well, let's get into the discussion here. And as I mentioned, this movie takes place sometime during Deep Space Nine or around the end of Deep Space Nine. It's not exactly clear where this movie falls on the timeline. It's the same year as the final events of Deep Space Nine as a series, but exactly where it falls within those events isn't clear. Matthew, I know you've dug into this a little bit. Where do you think this movie takes place on the timeline?
Well, it's really interesting. So I started to do some research because I was wondering, okay, when does this movie fall? Because, you know, we have talked at length with the Earl Grey gentleman about the fact that, you know, they never got an invitation to the wedding. And then, of course, nobody mentions Worf's wife dying and insurrection or anything. So one of the arguments is that it takes place, you know, during the series. We just did on the Ready Room, Only a Paper Moon, and Worf does not appear in that episode, and he also does not appear in Prodigal Daughter or The Emperor's New Clothes, and then he's back. So there's time for him to have been gone to this Manzar colony, and then, of course, hooking up with the Enterprise for a little bit. But this film also makes some strange references to the fact that the Enterprise is on its current mission, because the diplomatic corps is busy with Dominion's negotiations, which would be strange at that point of Deep Space Nine, because, well, there's no negotiation to be had. They're right in the middle of the war. They're not negotiating with us.
Right, right. So it would seem that if there were negotiations, they would be the negotiations at the very end. Now, we do see the ceremony where they do finally sign at the end, right? And the war has ended. So somewhere in between, maybe something happened. The thing about a story like that is you don't know how much time passes, even within one episode, how much time passes between the events that you see when they actually get to Cardassia and they go in and they defeat the female changeling, and then when we see the actual end of hostilities. Although, What You Leave Behind has a star date of 52902.0, and given one star date, you would think everything happens in a compressed time period, but of course, it couldn't really happen all in one day, right?
Well, that's my feeling as well.
And Insurrection, by the way, has an unknown star date, but
right,
these both take place in 2375.
So, it does seem like a time period, you know, once the war is ended, it does seem like something where, you know, obviously, you know, the Enterprise is kind of running around like a chicken with its head cut off, trying to do things as everybody else is busy trying to wrap up this war. And maybe Worf was taking some kind of vacation or running an errand or something, you know, for Deep Space Nine, and then runs into the Enterprise and they pick him up. And that would also make more sense, too, why nobody deals with the fact that Janzi has died. You know, that's, what, a whole year or more? You know, so if he had talked to anybody on the Enterprise at that point, it was probably by subspace, and he probably talked to somebody like Riker or Deanna or something like that after those events.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
You know, so I think it, honestly, to me, I would place this right after the Dominion War, but before the end of What You Leave Behind, where they sign on the dotted line. So
that makes sense to me. It fits in that way. That's a great point about why it's never mentioned about Jadzia. Not to diminish the death of Jadzia, and certainly not to diminish the impact that her death would have on Worf losing his wife, but with everything that was going on for everyone in Starfleet at that point in time, a year is a lot of time, and so much other stuff would have happened that this would no longer be like the first thing that would be mentioned to somebody. And also, I would say that, as I always picture in any episode, there's all kinds of stuff that happens that you don't see on screen. So just because we don't see them mention it, if we're going to say in universe here, just because they don't mention it on screen in the movie doesn't mean that Riker and Picard and Troy and everyone did not talk to Worf about Jadzia.
Well, and my guess is, yeah, I mean, you would expect to, you know, as they're traveling in those mountains on this planet and stuff like that, you know, I'm sure they're talking to Worf about different things. Hey, what's going on at Deep Space Nine? You know, I mean, he's got Deanna there, he's got Crusher there, and Data, and Picard. So I'm sure all of them are kind of having these conversations.
Sure.
So where I'd like to, I kind of have that in my head canon. That's where they're talking about him.
Yeah.
And you know, what his life has been like the last year, obviously being involved in this war, but two, you know, how are you doing after, you know, the death of your wife? Obviously, too, the way Picard greets him, "Mr. Worf, what the hell are you doing here?" You know, that doesn't really seem like the way that you would greet somebody if, you know, this was much earlier in the season, you know, where only a paper moon was, and you know, that's the time frame. That's a little too close to having just sure. lost your wife to be so jovial with somebody.
Yeah, they've already talked it out at this point. Now, speaking of that scene, we do have to talk about getting Worf to the Enterprise, because that's something that you have to do with these TNG movies. And last show, when we talked about First Contact, we talked about how much sense it made to have the Defiant there. And it was an absolutely perfect opportunity to get Worf onto the Enterprise. Here, on the other hand, as we talked to Michael Dorn about when we had him on the Orb, they weren't even trying at this point. It was almost like the writers saying, "We're not even going to try to explain this. Worf, what the hell are you doing here?" "Oh, well, I was visiting the Manzar colony," and da da da, and fade out. You know, and that's it. There's no other explanation whatsoever.
Well, and it is funny. I will say, I think that that's probably the thing that happens with this entire movie, is it kind of just feels like that. You know, from the very beginning, we don't really care what's going on. Even the storyline, we don't really care what's going on. I mean, Picard's going to get all self-righteous, but even he's having a hard time caring. You know, so it's just, it all stems from the very beginning where we're like, we're just going to bring Worf into this story, and we're not going to give you any explanation or good explanation for why. I mean, the best explanation, I think, would have been this, is that Worf was on, I mean, because the problem is Deep Space Nine hasn't ended by the time this actually came out, but my guess is that they have some idea how the show's going to end a little bit as they're writing this. But the best explanation would have been this, is that Worf was on his way to the Klingon Empire to be the ambassador, and runs into the Enterprise and decides, well, I got time, I can stop by the Enterprise and see everybody. You know, so that makes so much more sense than right. just, I'm at the Manzar colony, wherever the heck that is, you know, so.
Now, of course, what you're saying here would fit in with our idea that this takes place between the end of What You Leave Behind on Cardassia and then the final moment where we see them actually signing the treaty. Because at that point, Worf knows he's going to go off and be the ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
I think another option could be that if this took place earlier on in the season, maybe Martok and Worf, they just kind of really needed a break from all this fighting, and they decided to go on a fishing trip together to the Manzar colony, and the Enterprise just happened to cross paths with their ship. Because you know how, even though space is really, really huge, in Star Trek, ships and people tend to just run into each other by accident.
Well, yeah, I mean, space is pretty tiny. You know, we think it's so vast and big, but it's really, I mean, there's planets galore. People are bumping into each other all the time. It's weird. Yeah, that or a little targ hunting. Maybe they just needed,
okay.
you know, yeah.
Are there a lot of targ on the Manzar colony?
It is the largest collection of targ outside the Klingon Empire, actually. I didn't know if you knew that, Chris.
I did not know that. It's, no.
Yeah. Klingons from all over the galaxy come to hunt on that planet. And you have to have a special permit. It takes years to be able to get one. And, well, you know, once Martok had become the general of the Klingon forces, well, he got special treatment, so.
I see. Okay. Well, that's one other possibility there. So, about the Manzar colony. Okay, now here's a little bit of an explanation. They say, according to Memory Alpha, that Worf visited the Manzar colony in 2375 from Deep Space Nine to assist in constructing a new defense perimeter there. Now, that is not actually explained in the movie, though perhaps it was in a version of the script.
Well, there were so many versions of this script and so many different iterations of the story. The story was much better at the beginning, and it continually kind of got watered down and watered down to where the actual connections to things that were going on in the Star Trek universe or had gone on in the Star Trek universe really got taken away. So that wouldn't surprise me at all to know that that was probably somewhere there, but it just got cut.
I guess so. All right. Okay, well, let's go on and talk a little bit about some things that Worf does in this movie to see if there's anything that we can connect with Deep Space Nine. The thing that stood out the most to me, and I had not really thought about this in the past when I watched this movie, but watching it again to prepare for this show, I was watching how they were fighting when they were trying to move the Baku into the caves. So they're going along the hillside and they're being attacked by these little drones that are shooting the isolinear tags. And what struck me was that during the Dominion War, Worf and other Starfleet officers and the crew of Deep Space Nine, they found themselves in situations where they were on planets and they were having to fight outdoors against the Jem'Hadar. And this is something that Worf didn't do as much on TNG because we normally saw them on the ship. He was usually there on the bridge behind his tactical station. They did have away missions, but the away missions as presented on TNG tended to be more like in one location, right? You just go down to one spot on a planet. It's a bit different than the feeling that we got from the Dominion War. And so it struck me that Worf's experience with all of those ground battles on DS9 prepared him for what they had to do to get the Baku to the cave safely, more so than I felt Riker or Data or Picard were prepared, and of course Beverly or Troy or any of the other crew that beamed down. Worf seemed more uniquely prepared for that situation.
It is really interesting to think about that, and it's something that you were talking to me about before we started recording on the other side of the orb, and I thought that's a great point. And I kind of wish that we had seen maybe a little bit more of that, like maybe Picard putting Worf in charge of that, because of his experience and because he's basically acting tactical officer at this point. So on the Enterprise, now that he's back, he just picks up where he leaves off. It's just like, anytime he comes back,
I know,
whoever was at tactical just gets moved over for right. Worf.
Those poor officers, that's something we never think about. The guys, the ladies who are the tactical officers aboard the Enterprise who just, it's like Picard says, why don't you guys just take a vacation while Worf's here?
Yeah. So I'm wondering if, thinking about this, if there was maybe more of those scenes as well that they got cut. And maybe what,
of Picard telling the officers to go take a vacation?
No. of having, Worf maybe being a little bit more in charge.
It is
because I really like what you're saying, but the sad fact I feel like is that they just kind of play Worf up for laughs in this film.
Yeah.
And it could have been a nice character moment for him if he was kind of seen, even though he's having more aggressive tendencies, being able to take charge and he obviously is a great shot and he's fighting off these drones and everything and doing a great
everyone
job.
Is a great shot in this movie, Matthew.
It is true. Actually, Beverly and shoots one of those drones as well.
I don't think anyone missed a drone. I think they had a 100% accuracy rate.
Well, they've been practicing a lot in the holodeck.
Oh, with Guinan?
So, yes.
Yes. Just like Guinan and Riker used to do that phaser game on TNG.
Exactly. Where they have been practicing, and you do that enough times, and you're a great shot. So,
wouldn't it be funny if in order to have 100% accuracy, you had to wear a Guinan hat? Like that was part, because you were trained with Guinan, and had this kind of like this mental thing where unless you had the hat on, you couldn't hit your target.
I'm just imagining like Picard in one of those hats.
Well, I think now this is a Photoshop project. Scenes from Insurrection with them fighting the drones, but they all have Guinan hats on.
I want to see this. Somebody's going to do it in the Babel conference, and we're going to sit at our computers for a few good minutes and just laugh and laugh and laugh.
That would be awesome. So, yeah, it is true. Like you say, they do, for the most part, play Worf up for laughs in this movie. Not all the time, but let's think. So he has the big zit on his nose. He oversleeps. He hits his head on the ceiling of his room there because I guess it's different than what he's used to on the Defiant and on the station. He gets really long, lustrous hair. He doesn't want to sing Broadway songs. He hasn't yet met Gilbert or Sullivan because he hasn't been on the ship long enough. Let's see, what else does he do? You know, he, of course, reverts to the younger Klingon who is feeling aggressive tendencies.
I don't think you missed anything. I mean, you do have to give it to him. He does join in the singing. So
he does eventually join in a little bit, yes.
So good job.
Which I think the tagline for this movie for Worf, beautiful hair, not so beautiful voice.
That is true. That's not really his specialty. I do have to say, though, this movie, who knew that Patrick Stewart could sing quite so well? He does very well. So
I think at this point, I knew that because I think I've seen him sing even on SNL before. You know, back when they were doing like Love Boat, The Next Generation. I don't know if it was in that skit, but other skits Boat in that show as well. At some point along the line, I had seen him singing before, yeah.
Well, the Enterprise D just kind of looks like it would be the Love Boat of the Star Trek universe anyway.
You've seen that sketch, right?
I haven't.
Oh,
I need to go
it's
find
on
this.
YouTube. The copies I found on YouTube aren't very good. Like, there's not like a really nice, clean version of it. But there are some that people recorded off TV. But I remember when it first aired, and it's absolutely hilarious. It's the Love Boat, but it's the Love Boat, The Next Generation. And they've got like the Pacific Princes. Is that what it was called on the Love Boat? But it's got the nacelles coming out of it as well, and it's going through space. And their uniforms are, they have white Bermuda shorts for the pants.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
It's hilarious. And I think it was Chris Farley was Riker, if I remember correctly.
Oh, that's, I'm going to have to find this somewhere.
Tim Meadows is Geordi. Yeah, it's great. Man. So you should go check that out. And speaking of Patrick Stewart, if you can find the whole episode of Saturday Night Live when the Love Boat sketch was on, he also did a sketch where he ran an erotic bake shop.
Oh, gosh. Oh, gosh. Good. When Saturday Night Live was funny.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, this was early 90s when the show was really good. So let's talk a little bit more about Worf's scenes here, though. The bit with the singing, when that scene itself, I'm sort of borderline on whether I think that scene is incredibly cheesy and out of place or that scene works. When I first saw it, I especially thought, oh, really? You guys are going to do this. This is what I talked about last show where First Contact had some very humorous organic moments in it, and then they decided to just try to make Insurrection funny. But then on the other hand, I'm watching it and I'm thinking that this does make sense for TNG. It does make sense. It's the flavor that we have seen during the series. Maybe a little bit over the top, but Picard trying to get through to Data in this way. You know, Picard and Data used to work together on the holodeck doing Shakespearean plays and such. So it's not completely out of place. And it is funny to see Worf being involved in it.
I think this is one of the scenes where it's borderline, but it works. You know, you can make it work. And I think, you know, it was a strange thing coming from the very, very serious First Contact, but it had some genuinely funny moments in it. I mean, you know, like when Geordi doesn't know what to take a leak means. That's actually kind of funny. You know, those kind of things are like, all of that feels more organic.
Well, and my favorite moment is when Troy's head hits the bar and then Riker's head jerks over
yes,
to see her.
Yes. But yeah, I think that moment is fun. And I really enjoy that scene because I think you're right. It makes sense for the fact that Data already has a history of doing plays. He has a history of doing all these kind of things. So him being in this sounds like something Beverly's probably been doing in her off time, putting on a production of Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I think that part actually works. And it is funny because Worf would have that reaction. He would not want to sing. Worf doesn't do anything but Klingon opera.
That's right. I love Michael Dorn, how he played that part, though, where Picard tells him, come on, Worf, sing. And he just shakes his head very subtly, like, there's no way I'm doing that, Captain. Nope. Like, yeah. I'm scared to sing almost.
In fact, you know what's really funny is there is a scene in Star Wars, the original film, where Han Solo's like, Chewie, come here. And Chewie does the exact same head thing.
Yeah.
Where he's like, no, it's the same exact head movement that Worf gives, and it's awesome.
The other thing I like about this scene is when they show the display and it has the little bouncing ball going across the words. I don't know if you had this. You're a little bit younger.
It's like
younger.
A Disney sing-along.
Yeah, the sing-along. But I don't know if you had this game because you're a little bit younger than me, but I know many listeners probably did. On the Commodore 64, Ghostbusters had the little bouncing ball going across the words to the Ghostbusters theme song.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
And it was, at the time, it was kind of amazing because computers were not that advanced back then. And it's like, wow, the words are coming up and the ball's bouncing across them. It's really cool. And every time I see Insurrection and I see this scene, that's exactly what I think of, is the Ghostbusters game on Commodore 64.
That, yeah, it's funny because you mentioned that and I immediately just think of the really old school VHS videos, the sing-along videos that Disney used to put out.
Oh yeah, I remember those,
They would do the same exact thing, so.
But this reminds me also of a great theme song for the Federation, for Starfleet, set to the tune of the Ghostbusters theme. Dun, 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 dun. Belt buckles. Dun, 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 dun. I think it's one of Doherty's favorite songs.
I think so too. He also likes the verse about shoulder pads. So. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned, and we're going to jump off Worf here for a second. You mentioned before we started recording how this movie feels very cheap. Visually, it feels cheap. I know why that is, however, and I know why they weren't able to finish the collector scene, and so they left all the blue screens in. They blew the whole budget on Doherty's belt buckle.
That's what it is, because it looked pretty elaborate.
It was really elaborate, wasn't it?
And the gold trim, you know, for the couches on the Sona ship, that must be the other place, because they must have spent like 24 karat gold, you know, thread there, because I don't know what else in the world could possibly make a major studio release a film where a whole set piece is literally unfinished and the entire human race can tell.
Well, they spent money on the weirdest things. You know, they also, like an errand of mercy on TOS, they painted the goats so they would look different on camera. And I think they also painted the horses in Star Trek V, although you can't tell when you watch the movie. They also did that with the llamas in this movie.
I did catch that, actually, with this rewatch. I saw that. It was, you know, the other thing, too, not on top of the llamas, and apparently that paint was real expensive. But the other thing that really bothers me about just the look of this film is that I think I remember hearing this, that the set that they had built had been destroyed outside because of some sort of huge rainstorm. And I was disappointed to, because I feel like this place is supposed to have been there for a few hundred years. And it doesn't feel like that. It feels new.
It feels like it was just built, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And that really bothers me. A lot of the set decoration, and I love Herman Zimmerman, but it they just don't do a good job of making it feel like it belongs in this place for over 100, 200 some odd years. And I can say that, you know, obviously because we've all seen the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit films where they would go out and for a year or so beforehand, they built all this so that everything could grow around things. It could feel like it had been there. It could be weathered. And this whole setup, it's nice, but it looks like they just put it there 3 days ago.
Well, it could be that the mutagenic effects of the briar patch actually cause buildings to look new as well, Matthew.
They're continually regenerating their genetic structure of the buildings.
Right, right. The molecular structure of the buildings.
I love it. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That's okay, Chris. There we go. There's
the in-universe explanation.
Exactly.
It all comes back to the rings.
So can I go back to Doherty's belt buckle for a minute?
And please. We haven't talked enough about that belt buckle.
What I love about this belt buckle is that it looks like, it's almost like it's screen printed or something. It's like it's got the blue emblem of the Federation. It's like, it's not like a nice metal engraved belt buckle or something. It's like, it's colorful. It's got the emblem, and it looks like, I don't know. It looks like he's the tackiest admiral. Like some admirals, they want to have the big belt buckle, but they want it to be really classy looking. And he's just going to go full color, big, shiny.
Well, you notice too, who he's hanging out with. He seems to get along pretty well with these Sona people. He has said no to some of those pleasures, but I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. So maybe some of those people had decorated this belt buckle for him and he, you know, just wore it as a badge of honor or something. Yeah. And he didn't want to offend them. I don't know.
Do you think the belt buckle started off smaller and then they put it on that thing that stretches Rafo's face and then they just keep stretching it, making it bigger?
That's actually probably the best explanation. So I do want to ask you about something kind of serious with Worf. And, there's the part at the very end of the film where Riker and him and Geordi are standing there and Riker is wondering if, you know, he'll change once he leaves in his feelings for Troy. If those feelings will go away or if they'll stay there. Mm-hmm. I really like the way that it's Worf is the one who says, look, you have been in love with this woman ever since I met you, and those feelings have never gone away. So don't mess this up is basically what I feel like he's saying. You know, don't screw this up this time. And I love that I feel like Worf can only say that now after all the experience that he's had on Deep Space Nine. And especially with Jadzia, somebody who has lost a spouse would definitely say that. Stop wasting your time. You know, go be with the person you love. So yeah. I think I really liked that about this film. It's one of the best scenes, I think, in the movie because I feel like it kind of connects with the greater Star Trek whole. And it's one of the few things that feels really relevant to especially the Next Generation crew and actually making a change.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great point. And I don't think you need to lose a spouse in order to understand that and convey that to someone else. But if you do lose a spouse, then that would be even clearer to you. Like, don't waste time because you do get comfortable in your relationships, right? And you kind of assume that they're going to go on forever. And they're obviously not. I think it's a great connection back to Deep Space Nine, though, that this is some advice that the Worf of TNG would never give. I think he did not even understand this. And as we've talked about before, there was this just instant connection between him and Jadzia. And then as they grew together, and then they got married, and then, as we know, just before she was killed, they were planning to have a baby. You know, Worf's view of relationships had changed drastically. And knowing, like you said, having lost her and knowing how that's impacted him, when he goes back to the Enterprise and then he sees Riker and Troy in this setting, and then when Riker asks about that, I think it probably does trigger something in Worf to say, like, look, you guys, it's enough already. What has it been? Like, I've known you 10 years. Stop playing around. You know, you're not getting any younger, at least not after you leave the Briar Patch. You're not getting any younger. Yeah. Stop messing around. You know, it's time for you guys to be serious about it. So, yeah, that is an interesting thing. And it's definitely one of, it's probably the most obvious element of this movie, where you can take an experience that Worf had on Deep Space Nine and transfer it back over to the TNG setting.
Well, and I think too that this film would have been served well if it had had some more of these type of moments. Like it was, because I felt like that was a really nice scene, and a majority of the scenes with the Riker and the Troi are so kind of over the top, but this one was just very genuine when we're talking about that relationship, and it felt very real between these friends having this conversation. And I wish that there had just been more of, you know, you can do lighthearted and fun, but still feel more genuine. And I would have liked to have seen some more of that. And I think for me, that's why it's, you know, one of my favorite scenes in Insurrection, because of the way that it comes across. It, you know, these people have known each other for years, and these actors have too. And I just felt like that was a great scene. You know, sadly, a few scenes later, Data is doing the stupid finger trick to Riker, you know, with flicking him in the face. And it's just,
right?
You totally lose, you know, all that you had just earned with this great scene, with something stupid like that. So it was those moments in the film that really, I think, made it great. And you know, on top of that, I think the moment where Geordi is actually getting to see the sunrise, that was another great
moment. Yeah, that's a wonderful scene
as well.
That,
so,
you know, that moves me every time I see it. And I mean, it's a beautifully shot scene. And then again, LeVar Burton is one of those actors who is just so natural in his acting. And the way he plays that scene, you know, it's just a quiet moment, and it's very subtle, but I think it's beautifully shot and beautifully acted as well. So definitely. Well, I guess we've covered everything about Worf in this movie. There's really not a lot here. The biggest connections are his love advice to Riker and his experience in the Dominion War, fighting on the ground, fighting outdoors, fighting in different environments, and being able to help move the Baku to safety, which we don't really get to see very clearly in this movie, but I do think it's there. And if you were actually there in the moment on the ground, I'm sure that Picard was getting a lot more advice from Worf, and Worf was probably leading that move a lot more than what we see. So those are the big things. Well, let's talk a little bit about the movie itself, as we've been doing with the last two. People listening probably think that we really hate this movie, or, you know, we're making fun of it a lot. I like this movie, actually, though I think that it could have been so much better. I think it has a really fantastic premise. I think that the Baku in particular had some really wonderful comments that they made, you know. So, Jeff, the premise of it, why the Baku have chosen to reconnect with nature and not to actually use the technology that they have, you know, building positronic brains or using warp power or whatever they could go do, they've decided that they just want to live quietly on this planet. So Jeff has comments about that. Anish has comments about that. I love the connection between... I love how Anish pulls Picard into that a bit and helps pull him away, and in turn pull the viewer away from all the space wrappings of Star Trek for a moment, and kind of bring you back to real everyday life. But the film overall, it just doesn't feel cohesive enough. There's, like we said, too many poorly timed jokes. Visually, it feels like they were going through the motions. Even before this movie was released, when I first saw the poster, I'm like, you guys are just going through the motions this time, aren't you? Because it's basically a reskinned First Contact movie poster. They didn't even bother to try to create anything really unique for this movie. Title screen's terrible, you know, it's just this red on black, what's white, and then the same, the title comes in red, and then it turns red. I'm like,
it's not good.
After the beautiful opening of First Contact, this is the best you can do. it was that time where I think Paramount was so comfortable with Star Trek, CBS was so comfortable with Star Trek, that they were completely on autopilot here.
Well, and from reading the fade-in book by Michael Piller, it's very clear that his idea was to do something much bigger, bolder, brassier. I mean, he really was shooting for the fences with this film, and it was going to be something that connected with a lot that had been happening in Star Trek recently with, you know, Deep Space Nine, and feel very important to the Star Trek universe and for these characters. And it nobody was going for it. And so it just continues to get watered down and watered down and watered down until we get what we get, which is literally just a two-part episode. And I know it's been said before about Insurrection, but that's really what it feels like. With maybe
what it looks
some,
like as well.
Right. It maybe has some slightly better effects than a TV episode, but not much, especially an Enterprise episode these days looks better. So
Well, the CGI of the ships is, when you watch it today, it really feels dated.
It's, yeah, it's really awful. Partly because they don't have ILM doing the effects. It's somebody else. And you can tell it feels like the Star Trek V of the Next Generation series because of the way the effects turn out, which really does impact the movie a lot.
Now, the effects are a lot better than Star Trek V, but compared to First Contact, it's...
Well, yeah.
Not on the same level.
And I mean, too, the effects for Star Trek V are what, 86, you know?
Maybe,
so, I mean, it's.
Yeah, 88, yeah.
But generally, it's frustrating because it's not a terrible story or anything. It just, when you're following up First Contact, you got to do better. Yeah. And unfortunately, TNG just didn't.
Yeah, if this had followed up Generations, maybe people would have a somewhat more favorable view of it. But following up First Contact, it really did feel like a really big letdown. I remember leaving the theater and feeling let down by this movie.
I remember that too. We went and saw it opening day. I was so excited. I remember it was so frustrating to me too because, you know, I was at that point where I was really starting to get into film and really enjoying that thing. And my fandom was at an all-time high, you know, especially after First Contact. And, you know, getting the Dallas paper and seeing the review that day, and I was like, oh, well, it's just a review. They don't know what they're talking about. So I go to the film and, you know, and then I get out and I'm like, I guess they knew what they were talking about.
Yeah.
So it's definitely disappointing. You know, it has some nice things that it's trying to say, but it gets so lost in the Uber cheese that it kind of misses everything.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say that Gates McFadden looks absolutely beautiful in this movie.
She does. She looks great. Sadly, she barely gets anything to do. Luckily, she has a nice scene at the very beginning with the captain where they're kind of flirting almost with each other, which was kind of nice. And then, of course, he goes off and flirts with the knees, so apparently Picard gets around.
I guess. Well, she does get to shoot a drone, so.
That is true. And, and talk about her boobs with
I know,
Marina Sirtis, which is the most awkward scene ever. Awkward.
It's not the most awkward scene. The most awkward scene is then when Data goes and talks to Worf about his boobs.
That may be the lowest of the low points in this film because it's where you understood that the humor wasn't really humor at all. So.
Right. I mean, someone should have said, look, this whole sequence here needs to go. Right. This is not appropriate humor for the audience that is the target of this movie, right? This isn't like a Nickelodeon movie.
It would have been, it would have been different if it had just been a conversation by themselves without Data there.
Yeah.
It's a little bit different if it's just those two talking about, and because the point is to make that subtle commentary about what we're not supposed to care about by then, but we still do kind of care about because we're human and we care about what we look like.
But I would still phrase it in a way where it's more of not played as humor, you know, like don't make it like, oh, have you noticed that your boobs have firmed up? You know, just make it like, have you noticed that you're feeling younger or something like that, you know? what I would have done.
It could have been played so much better, and it just wasn't. And then, of course, it's made completely awful by the fact that Data needs to go and repeat it.
Yeah.
Like, Data doesn't know. And that's the other thing that's right. terrible about this movie, is that where's his emotion chip? It's like they have reverted Data back to Data from the original first season of this show, as if he doesn't have an emotion chip, and like he's never done any growing.
Yeah.
It's awful. It's just awful.
Now, I would say that you could argue that the emotion chip was either damaged when he was damaged, or in repairing him, Geordi had to remove the emotion chip. But the thing that gets him damaged in the first place is him making a decision about what the Federation is doing there that's based, I would say, more on calculations rather than emotion. I mean, you could say that it's emotion, that he doesn't like what they're doing, and so he's going to stop them. But it's played more like that goes against his programming. Like, he must protect these people based on his programming, in which case it would seem that, like you say, they've just kind of forgotten that he has an emotion chip.
Which doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. And I think that's what happens when you watch this film, and if you watch it too much, you just start saying, that doesn't make sense. So, and I think we were talking before we started, and I said, you know, it probably didn't help that I rewatched this movie, because I do kind of feel like the more that I watch it, the more my opinion goes down, I think, because the flaws become a lot more glaring if you watch it a lot.
Especially if you watch it on Blu-ray.
Yeah, yes, 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 they do, especially the scenes that aren't finished.
So. Okay, so let's talk about that real quick before we wrap up. I was just picturing last night when I got to that scene where the collector is unfinished and you can see the blue screens, and I can just picture a group sitting in a room saying, you know, the scene's not finished, can we release it? And they're probably justifying to themselves, like, well, it doesn't look that bad. It is bright blue. It's kind of spacey looking. I think people probably will just be okay with it. Why don't we just go ahead and put it out?
I'm just waiting for the fan edit of this film, for somebody who goes in and takes that blue screen, which it's already there for you, and edits it so that there's actually something in the background.
I can see that becoming a YouTube thing where you just drop in all kinds of things. Like, there's one where there's like cats playing in the background.
There's like hamsters on wheels making right. the thing go.
Oh, that they're operating the collector.
There's 42,000 hamsters that make this thing go.
Yeah, that could become a thing. All right.
I want to see that. We've started some great memes here tonight, Chris.
We have, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that's pretty much everything on Insurrection. I mean, for me, this movie is very much like Star Trek V for me. There are a lot of things in this movie that I really like a lot, but overall, I feel like it's poorly executed, and it's just a disappointment because they could have done so much better. And yeah, that's how I feel, and it would have been great if they had given Worf more to do, but hey, you know, it's a TNG film, so it's Picard and Data.
Yeah, you know, for me, this is at the low end of the spectrum. Sadly, the low end of the spectrum for me for Star Trek films is filled up by TNG films. Nemesis, Generations, and Insurrection. I won't tell you where those end up until we talk our next time about Nemesis. But yeah, it's just, it is frustrating. And it was sad, especially at that point for me, because, you know, Deep Space Nine was coming to a close, Insurrection kind of bombs, and Star Trek Voyager is still on the air, but it's okay, you know, but it's just like you could tell that something was missing from Star Trek, you know, from the heights of First Contact. It just kind of all goes downhill after 1996.
Well, it's interesting that at a time when DS9 was telling its best stories and very intricate stories, you had Voyager, which I think had slid a bit. You know, the peak of Voyager was maybe like season 5, 6 with its best stories. And then you've got Insurrection doing this story. So with DS9 doing such great material, it makes you wonder why Insurrection wasn't able to elevate that. But like you said, Michael Piller was trying to do something else, but he wasn't able to do what he wanted to do. And we got, you know, this instead. And of course, Michael Piller being one of the creators of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, and Michael knew his stuff. And, you know, I think really, again, he had a bold idea. So I want to give it to him. I don't blame him, you know. As our good friend Larry Nemechek likes to say, this is kind of what happens in Hollywood. You put things through the meat grinder, and what comes out isn't always wonderful sausage, you know? So this is just kind of what we got. And well, I guess we'll see where we end up next time when we're talking about Star Trek Nemesis.
Exactly. And speaking of Michael's book there, you guys talked about that on Literary Treks, right? Do you remember the episode number?
We did, Chris, and that episode was number 90, Through the Brita Filter.
All right, good. So go check that out if you want to know more about what Michael Piller was trying to do with Insurrection. And tell us what you think about Worf and Insurrection. You can do that by going to the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. That's the best place to get into a real discussion with us and other listeners. Matthew, tell everyone how to get there.
Well, Chris, so you can go over to Facebook and type Babel into the search field, and we will let you into that group. It is the listeners-only group, so just ask to be let in, and one of our moderators will let you in. And it's a great place to have a discussion about anything that we're talking about all over Trek FM. You know, we have all the different shows, plus the 602 clubs. There's so many different conversations right now, so make sure that you do that and join in the conversation with the rest of us.
And speaking of things you can talk about in the Babel Conference, we talk about all sorts of things here on Trek FM, not just Worf, not just Insurrection. So here's a quick look at some of those other things.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
You've heard Chief Tripp sign on. I'm serious, Ken. Actually, out of the chair, please.
Okay. God.
I guess the Commodore has the con.
To the journey! All right, next one is from Damian Haywood. And, Damian, come on. Which Voyager crew member would you hate to be stuck in the Delta Flyer with? He's always so negative. I called him on this the other day. I said, Damian, why always with the negativity? He said, at least I'm consistent. The 602 Club.
We start getting hints of Thor. We start getting hints of Cap. We start getting hints of the entire Avengers crew. And we get Black Widow. So, I mean, Iron Man 2, considering how maybe that's not my favorite movie of the MCU, really does set up a lot of what is to come.
Literary Treks.
You know, visually, to me, this is one of my favorite eras of Star Trek. You know, those monster maroon coats they're wearing, and they're just absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, a lot of people talked about wanting to get a Captain Sulu Star Trek series, and one of the big reasons for me that would be so great is to see this era played out visually on a regular basis.
Women at Warp.
Her voice as a computer voice has become so iconic that when Google started developing what is now known as Google Now, that personal assistant you can speak to, they had initially codenamed it Google Majel.
That's so cool.
Isn't that awesome?
Meta Treks.
And I kind of had the jingle in my head, you can be a winner at the game yes. of life. And I was trying to think of the Star Trek version of that. You know, you can be a winner of the poker game of life on the Enterprise. It didn't really roll off the tongue, so.
It was great until you added on the Enterprise.
Melodic Treks.
The reason why I think Brian Reitzel would be a more plausible choice is because he has worked with Fuller in the past. They worked together on Hannibal. He scored that series, all 39 episodes. The neat thing about Brian Reitzel's music is it's more of a sound design than it is a score.
Saturday Morning Trek.
One of the characters is sizably larger than the other. So
he's just closer to the camera, Aaron, obviously.
But he's actually behind the other person.
He's a giant.
Wait, then he doesn't need a laser cutter. He can just lift the hatch up with it. Go down and get it.
Okay. Continuing mission.
Yeah, and of course, another great thing is when it's
it's all finished and you look at it and go, yeah, we made that together. Yeah, that's one of the greatest moments. And people respond to it and say, oh, that's pretty well made. The effects are great. The actors are great, even though they're Dutch trying to speak English, right?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. Of course, we're in iTunes, where we're a featured content provider with Apple. You can easily get there by going to itunes.com/trekfm. While you're over there, leave us a star rating and a written review if you have a moment. We'd love to hear what you think about the show, and that does help other Star Trek fans find the Orb as they're searching for Star Trek podcasts in iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. You can go to our website and stream from the show pages and download the MP3 files or grab the RSS link. If you use a third-party podcatcher, just search for Trek.fm and all of our shows should pop up right there. We'd also like to take a quick moment and thank our associate producers here on The Orb. We'd like to thank Will Wynn, Ruth Ward, and Ken Tripp for helping us get The Orb put together and out to you guys every show. We really could not do this without their support or with the support of our other patrons who support us through Patreon. If you would like to become an associate producer, if you'd like to become more involved in the network in other ways, even get on mic and talk Star Trek with us on the Patrons Roundtable, you can find out everything that you need to know at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We have all the information that you need over there, including information about perks, our exclusive website Patron Zone, where we do early releases sometimes, and we have other things there as well, like wallpapers and ringtones and avatars, and sometimes video clips as well. Again, you'll find it all at patreon.com/trekfm, and we really thank you for your support in keeping the network going. Now, if you'd like to send us some feedback beyond the Baywell Conference, there are other ways for you to get in touch with us. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. Use the form that you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose The Orb, and that'll come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also find us on Twitter, where our username is TrekFM, or you can send us a voicemail by going to speakpipe.com/TrekFM, that's the word speak and the word pipe together, .com/TrekFM. You just need the mic on your tablet, your phone, or your computer, and you can upload that to us right there on the page as an MP3 file. Now, Matthew, when you're not lathering and rinsing, lathering and rinsing, lathering and rinsing with some Klingon tail and mane to keep your hair as lustrous as it is today, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02, and I am also here on the network talking a lot of Trek with Literary Treks with Dan, where we're talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. So if you enjoy things in the Prime universe and all over the place, make sure you check that out. And of course, we're doing interviews with the authors as well. It's so much fun. You can also find me doing the 602 Club, which is our general geek show. Now, I know everybody here on Trek FM loves different franchises, not just Star Trek. So we devote that show to all the different franchises that we love. So make sure you check that out each week for what we're talking about. And then, of course, I'm on a brand new podcast with my friend John Mills called Aggressive Negotiations, and that is a Star Wars podcast, and you can find that on iTunes under Aggressive Negotiations.
Are you guys going to be starting your young Klingon podcast called Aggressive Tendencies?
That's actually kind of a funny idea. Oh, man. Well, Chris, when you're not thinking of new podcasts that you can start devoted to Klingon hygiene, where can we find you?
Klingon hygiene. That'd be great, though. I might could get some sponsors for that. You know, I could get like Dove. I can get Pantene, many different, you know, Clearasil, I think.
There you go. Yeah, for those gorges, they get pretty big.
Right. I'm just picturing now a commercial on Kronos for gorges, and they're like rubbing the cream. They're probably using like a Metleth to rub the cream on their face.
That's going to have to be a big bottle of Clearasil for that. I mean, Gorch's, Klingon suit don't do anything small, do they?
No, I was going to say, you don't have to worry. It will be a big bottle because Klingons don't do anything small.
They only shop at Costco.
That's right. And when you buy in bulk, no one thinks it's odd.
Yeah, I don't even know if they have normal grocery stores. They're all just like Sam's Clubs and Costco's.
Worf's like, can you help me get stuff out of the car? I got a 6-barrel pack of blood wine. All right. Yeah, when I'm not doing those things, you can find me elsewhere on the network on The Ready Room, where we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series, as well as Star Trek news. Matthew is on with me on the latest Ready Room, which is about Deep Space Nine. We're also joined by Zachary Frühling, and we're talking about It's Only a Paper Moon. That's out right now, so go pick that up. Episode 197 of The Ready Room. You can also find me on Hyper Channel, which is our short news show. And you can find my writing over on the official website at StarTrek.com.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.